Orson Welles Speaks. Listen in to what the director of Citizen Kane had to say during his final years in newly released Intimate Conversations. We'll talk to Peter Biskind, editor of My Lunches with Orson.
All he said was he didn't want to see the tape recorder because I think it would have inhibited him. Not that anything would inhibit him, really.
Henry Jaglom, the independent film director who spoke with Welles.
We have a lot of fun in those lunches, and the real character of Orson Welles, the real charming, lovely, provocative, and sometimes very sad and disappointed man comes out in the book.
The bad guys make for the best TV today. We'll talk with Brett Martin, author of Difficult Men, to find out why.
Why do we want Walt White from Breaking Bad to succeed when he's really a monster?
Julie Bosman will be here to discuss the big news with Barnes & Noble this week. And Greg Holes will be here with Bestseller News. I'm Pamela Paul, and you're listening to Inside the New York Times Book Review.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Peter Biskind is here. He is the editor of a new book, My Lunches with Orson, Conversations Between Henry Jaglom and Orson Welles, which is reviewed on our cover this week by Maureen Dowd. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. So this book is based on transcripts of conversations that occurred between Welles and Jaglom that you had heard about a long time ago. Tell me about how you came across these.
Well, I wrote a book published in 1998 called Easy Riders, Raging Bulls about Hollywood in the 70s, the so-called New Hollywood. And in the course of doing the research for that book, I ran across Henry Jaglom, who had been very involved in a company named BBS in the late 60s, early 70s. BBS was famous for producing Easy Rider, The Last Picture Show, and Carnal Knowledge. It was sort of the engine that drove the so-called New Hollywood. And Jaglom was good friends with the people that ran BBS. He was good friends with Jack Nicholson. He was good friends with Warren Beatty. He was very well connected. And he kept diaries, detailed diaries, all through the late 60s and the 70s. And so we got to be friendly, and I used some of the stuff from his diaries, which was very helpful to me. And he also alluded to the fact that he had these Orson Welles tapes, but he had just stuck them away after Welles died in 1985. He'd stuck them away in a shoebox, essentially, and just had gone on to other things and had forgotten about him, didn't remember what was on the tapes. He had regularly lunched with Welles for 5 years, and the last three of those years he recorded the conversations, and that's what the tapes were.
So this was 1983
to 85. Right,
that's the year that Welles died.
Right, and I think the last recording was something like 10 days before Welles died.
Oh, wow. And how did Jaglom get to know Welles?
Well, he used Welles in his first film, A Safe Place, and the story about how they met is in my introduction. And it's very amusing. And they stayed, they became friends during the shooting of that film. He also used Welles in another film many, many years later. He ran into Welles, I believe, in something like 78 at Ma Maison, which was the hot restaurant in those days. So hot that they didn't publish their phone number. Welles was struggling. He was one of those people who had an amazing early career. He was on the cover of Time magazine when he was like 23 or something for his theater work. And he had made Citizen Kane in 1941, which is still one of the most remarkable movies ever made. But, what was the follow-up going to be? What was the second act? And it turned out the second, third, acts were very, very disappointing, difficult, tortured. And Welles had never had a success like Citizen Kane. And Anyway, Jaglom, he was trying to get a lot of projects off the ground, and Jaglom realized that he could help him because Jaglom had been raising money for his own films in Europe, and he could do the same thing with Wells, and Wells was very grateful to that for that.
In the 70s, Wells had still had this great reputation, but nobody wanted to work for him.
Because he had a reputation for walking away from his films and getting bored with his films in the middle of them, or something would always happen, you know, and whether it was Wells' fault or whether it was circumstance, nevertheless, the films never got finished.
I take it he didn't walk off the set of Jaglom's film.
No, he didn't.
What was the story about? How did they meet Jaglom and Wells?
Well, Wells wanted to use him for a safe place, and Jaglom had a good mutual friend, Peter Bogdanovich, who had been a journalist for a long time and had, I think, met Wells doing journalism. He asked Peter to introduce them. Peter told him, Henry, that Wells was staying at the Plaza Hotel in New York, asked Jaglom if he had a script, because Wells would never consider anything without a project without a script. And Jaglom said no, but he was going to do it anyway. And Jaglom was very, forward, very bold. He had a real director, filmmaker's mentality, which was he wasn't going to take no for an answer. So he went to New York, knocked on Wells' door, and got a fairly cold, hostile answer, but he sort of plowed ahead and got Wells somehow to accept this role. He was very good, Jaglom, at getting people to do what they didn't want to do.
And these conversations, I'm assuming Orson Welles knew that they were being taped.
Yes, he did. All he said was he didn't want to see the tape recorder because I think it would have inhibited him. Not that anything would inhibit him, really, but Jaglom put the tape recorder in a bag. The recordings were done in a restaurant with a lot of background noise, so the quality of the tapes is not great. There was enough on them to warrant a book.
Let's listen to a little bit of them. This is a bit about Charlie Chaplin. Can you give us some background on...
Well, Wells knew everyone, and he certainly knew Charlie Chaplin. He knew him well, and he actually wrote the script for Mr. Verdú, which Wells claimed then Chaplin screwed him out of the credit for. So he tells a lot of Chaplin stories, and so Jaglom comes to Chaplin sort of wide-eyed and wonders whether Chaplin did all the gags himself, and Wells disabuses him of that notion, and it's in a very amusing way.
Do you know whether Chaplin had everything planned out or did a lot of improvising?
He didn't improvise much, but he didn't plan the picture structure. He just he always had six gagmen.
Chaplin had six gagmen?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Chaplin didn't invent all of
the only things. One who did his own invention was Harold Arlen. No doubt. The only totally original comedian.
I'm devastated. Chaplin had gag men?
And what was to you the most the best part of these Chaplin discussions?
Well, he talks a lot about how Chaplin he has a whole theory of Chaplin, which is goes into the history of clowns. But for me, it was interesting that Chaplin he would always act out whatever film he was working on at dinner parties in L.A. And he would always be invited, and he would monopolize the party and act out the whole film, which had two consequences. One of them, which was he was not invited to many dinner parties because he would suck the air out of the room. And B, by the time he actually got to make the film, it was stale for him. At least that was Welles' take on it.
Orson Welles, obviously another huge personality. How does he come across in the tapes?
Well, he comes across in several different ways. He's very funny. I was amazed at how smart he was and the breadth of his knowledge, which was enormous. I mean, and he had opinions about everything, and the crazier and nuttier the opinions were, the more ingeniously he would defend them. You know, he would not back down. He would say something absurd, and if you questioned him, he wouldn't back down. He would just spin out a really interesting rationale for something sort of crazy, like, he went into a tirade about the Irish, or he went into a whole tirade about justifying reacting to people based on their physical characteristics, you know, that he didn't like Woody Allen because of the way he looked, or he could never bear to look at Betty Davis, or that he said that Marlon Brando had a neck like an old shoe, you know. One might be embarrassed to say things like that, but not Wells, you know. He just went ahead and merrily defended them. Anyway, and then there's the bitter, angry Wells, you know, who was in the twilight of his career and couldn't get a project financed, and he obsessed over John Hazman, who had been a colleague and a close friend of his for many years in the early years in the Mercury Theater. But now his career had eclipsed Wells, and what was more galling, it eclipsed him in what Wells was actually turned out to be very good at, was commercials.
How many hours of tape was there to go through?
Well, I don't know, because they came to me as transcripts.
Okay.
And there must have been, I don't know, 30 or 40 tapes all told.
30 or 40 hours of material.
At least, yes, at least.
I'm assuming you went through and edited a lot of this down.
Well, yeah, it had to be edited because, you know, when you're doing conversations, even these are not interviews, so they ramble, you know, there's a lot of ordering of food. There's a lot of people coming up to the table, interrupting them, some of which are in the book because they're amusing.
What was to you the most revealing part of these transcripts?
Well, I guess towards the end, he spoke frankly about his economic financial problems and how desperate he was. And, you know, Jaglom was not successful in raising money for Wells. I mean, everybody would lead him on, and then at the last minute, the deal would fall through. His commercial work had disappeared, and he had been married three times. He had three daughters. He was paying a lot of money out in those kinds of fees and obligations, and still trying to keep up a quote-unquote life, somewhat of a lifestyle, although it was pretty circumscribed. And he was desperate towards the end, and desperate to get something financed, desperate for money. And he was really frank about that, and that was really interesting to me. I mean, nobody really has a clear picture of what Wells' last years were like, and this book does that.
What do those last years look like? How do they come across to you?
One of the amazing things about him is that bitter and unhappy in a way that he was hopeful throughout the whole end of his life. You know, he was hopeful that X script would get financed, and he was creative. I mean, he was writing wonderful scripts. He was a wonderful writer. It was, I guess, fairly well known. When he died of a heart attack in the middle of the night, he was sitting with a typewriter on his lap writing a script. And so, you know, it was a combination of this, of hopefulness, optimism that just around the corner would be a guy with the money, you know, for the movie, for Macbeth, or whatever, you know, whatever it was. He had five or six films, projects that he was, you know, on the verge of making, it seemed, and then they all fell through. And every once in a while, he would say pessimistically, "Oh, it's never going to happen. It never happens. It will never happen for me," you know. And he would bounce back.
All right. Well, Peter Biskind, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for asking me.
That was Peter Biskind talking about the new book, My Lunches with Orson, Conversations Between Henry Jaglom and Orson Welles. Peter Biskind edited this collection of conversations between the great director and another great independent contemporary director, Henry Jaglom. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains, Real and Imagined, written and read by Chuck Klosterman. That's I Wear the Black Hat, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
We were just speaking with Peter Biskind, editor of the new book My Lunches with Orson, reviewed on our cover this week. And the book is Conversations Between Henry Jaglom and Orson Welles. We'll now talk to Henry Jaglom, who was at those lunches. Henry is calling in from Los Angeles. Hi, Henry.
Hi.
So tell us a little bit of backstory here. How did you grow up as a huge Orson Welles fan?
Yeah, because I wanted to be a movie director since quite an early age, and Orson Welles was sort of the prototype of the ultimate movie director in one's mind, even before I think I saw his films. And then after seeing Citizen Kane, like everybody else, I was completely hooked.
When did you finally meet him for the first time?
I directed him in my very first movie, A Safe Place, in 1970, came out in 71. Peter Bogdanovich, who was a friend of mine, arranged for me to meet him, and I went to New York, and I had to talk this man, this extraordinary man, into doing a movie that he didn't want to do at that time. So it was quite an intense meeting. But I persuaded him finally to play this lapsed wonder rabbi in A Safe Place with Jack Nicholson and Tuesday Weld. And then we ran into each other again in Hollywood in the late 70s, I think it was 79, and we started having an occasional lunch together. And by 81 and 82, we were having lunch almost every other week. And the book that Peter Biskind put together of our recorded lunches took place in 83, 84, and 85, right until a week right before he died.
Let's go back to that first film that you worked on with him. First, what convinced him to finally take on this role?
Well, he was very reluctant. He was this gigantic purple grape that answered the door in these huge silk pajamas, these purple silk pajamas, and was, you know, very intimidating, and said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm here to try to convince you to be in my movie." And he said, "Where's the script?" And I said, "Well, the character you would be playing is not in the script, and because if you don't play it, I'm not going to use that character." And he said, "Well, I'm not going to make a film by a person who's never directed a film before and doesn't have a script." And I said, "I've flown 3,000, whatever it is, miles here, and I need an hour to talk to you." And he said, "Well, I'll sit here, but I won't listen." Crossed his arms and looked up, and I started trying to sell this story, and I remembered that he was a magician, that that was a very important part of Orson's life. So I started talking about this character who was a magician, and I finally realized that I got him when he turned and looked at me and said, "Can I wear a cape?" And I knew I had him. But I also directed him in what turned out to be his last movie, Someone to Love, the year he died in 1985. So I had the great pleasure of directing him twice, and he directed me in The Other Side of the Wind, which is his great unreleased final film.
So that there was a 15 years then between those two films?
Yes, exactly.
And how different was the experience of working with him?
It was very, very different. And the first film, he was very defiant, very difficult for the first few days. And then he looked at me one day and he said, "You're trying to do something kind of interesting here," because I was making a rather unorthodox film for Columbia Pictures, a really kind of independent art film for a big studio, which was a strange thing to do. And he said, I said, "Yeah, I'm having a hard time." And he said, "In what way?" And I said, "Well, the crew and the cinematographer who came from Love Story directly to me, they were all expecting a much more conventional director. And every time I ask them to do something which is not in the script, they point to the script and they say, 'It's not in the script. It won't cut. It won't cut. This won't fit. Where is this?'" And I said, "You know, I'm trying to create this as I go along in my own way." And he said, "I'll tell you what you do. When you get back after lunch," this discussion was at lunch, he said, "You tell them when they say to you, 'It won't cut,' or 'Where does it fit?' You just tell them it's a dream sequence." And I said, "A dream sequence? Why?" He said, "Just tell them." So we went back to work, and sure enough, within like 10 minutes, I asked for a certain kind of shot, and the cinematographer said, "It won't cut," and the script supervisor said, "It won't cut." And I said, "It's a dream sequence." And they went, "Oh my God, a dream sequence." And the cinematographer got on his back. He said, "This would be a great, like, psychedelic," they used for his shot. And everybody was incredibly willing to go along. And I said to him after that afternoon, "I can't understand this. Why does this work? What does a dream sequence mean to them?" And he said, "You know, these are very hardworking people. This crew consists of people who have tough lives. They've worked hard, and everything has a place and a logic to them. But the one place that they are completely free in their minds is during their dreams. They know that dreams don't have rules. So if you free them from the concept of having to have solid, restricted, narrow definitions of things by telling them it's a dream sequence, all their creativity can flourish, and they can be very open and wonderfully helpful." And that's what's been helping me ever since. Every single movie, I've made 19 or 20 movies now, I've had a problem at one time or another, and I've said it's a dream sequence, and it has done the trick.
Was there a moment in your conversations where you really felt like he opened up and sort of and revealed that person, that who he was?
Oh, yeah, there's so much of that in this book. And Peter Biskin did such a brilliant job of editing.
What were you planning to do with the tapes?
Nothing. I just thought they were private between myself and Orson, and he didn't live to turn them into anything or use them for his autobiography. And so I just put them away. And over the years, several people came to me about them who knew about that. And I said, no, I don't have the energy. I'm making films. I can't, you know, be involved in this. And Peter Biskin is somebody who I was friends with and trusted. And he wrote this wonderful book, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls. And I knew he would really do a serious and terrific job honoring Orson's memory and not somehow, you know, in any way misdirecting it. And he has done that in spades.
What was the fear that someone else might do with the material?
Well, you know, Orson was difficult, and he was very, very vehement in his opinions. And if you read the book, you will see he is full of prejudices against short people, against different nationalities in Europe, obscure kind of concepts that seem very alien to us about the Greeks and their short legs or something. You know, he was irascible, and he loved to be controversial, and he was difficult. Not to me. We got along so well. We had lunch once a week, every week practically for the last 4 or 5 years of his life. And so with me, he was really open and friendly and warm, though he liked to attack me for my, you know, he had been a very famous Hollywood progressive, and I'm quite progressive and liberal myself, and he liked to provoke me by trying to say, you know, things, the ultra-conservative things and so on, so which he didn't really believe. So we have a lot of fun in those lunches, and the real character of Orson Welles, the real charming, lovely, provocative, endlessly controversial, and sometimes very sad and disappointed man comes out in the book, I think, incredibly well.
When you look at the book now, is there a moment that you had forgotten about, or that what's your favorite thing to relive in the book?
I think that the most fun I have is when he tries to provoke me and says outrageous things. And I, unfortunately, what you can't do on book, but the tape I think is coming out as well, is he laughs a lot. And it gives him away, kind of, that he's being provocative and saying sometimes seemingly, you know, outrageous or provocative things. And I just love those. I don't have one particular moment, I think, that stands out. It's just so much life and so much erudition. I mean, he was incredibly bright, and he had great knowledge in all sorts of fields. And he shared them with such energy and such charm, and sometimes very, very hurt by life and by the disappointments he had, the inability to get financing, which was unfortunately the hallmark of his last 15, 20 years. I spent a lot of my energy when I was not making my own films trying to get him financing, and I went to all the heads of studios, you know, who were my generation and at this point were running things and could have helped him, and several of the biggest stars of the period, and no one would help at that point because they had this, you know, none. I don't know if you know this, but none of Orson Welles' films made any money. They all were commercial failures, though they're great works of art. I mean, for me, F for Fake, which was his last completed film, is as brilliant as Citizen Kane. There's a lot of sadness, too, in the book, I think, because he recognizes that he's having a lot of difficulty and that nobody's really coming through. And there's occasional hopefulness. I thought it was my job to keep things going and keep trying to keep him hopeful and actually try to find the financing, though I was incapable of doing that, unfortunately.
All right. Well, the book is My Lunches with Orson, Henry Jaglom. Thank you so much. You had the great fortune and opportunity of being at those lunches, and thank you for joining us here.
Thank you very, very much.
Julie Bosman is here with Notes from the Field. Julie, what's going on in the publishing world this week?
Well, anyone who thinks that there is nothing happening in the summer in the publishing world was very wrong this week. We had two huge news developments, and the first one was in Barnes & Noble, which is having a very tough week and actually a very tough summer. I would say that the story really started a couple of weeks ago when Barnes & Noble announced their quarterly earnings, which were devastating to say the least. They had very steep losses, and they made an announcement that signaled a real backtracking in one of their main digital efforts in the last few years. They said that they would no longer manufacture color tablets. Now this week, as sort of a follow-up to that earnings report, their CEO, William Lynch, resigned from the company.
Let's backtrack a little bit because, I mean, Barnes & Noble, it would seem that they were in a great position. Borders obviously went out of business. The independents were supposedly struggling. And here you had this one retailing giant left. What went wrong?
Right. For many years, through the 90s, through the 2000s, you had these two huge chains that were really fighting against each other. And when Borders went out of business 2 years ago, Barnes & Noble was left as really the only national book chain. So a few things really went wrong. Barnes & Noble decided that they needed a digital strategy. So in 2009, they released their first e-reader called the Nook. This was actually a pretty good success. Barnes & Noble grabbed a lot of market share early on. They now have about 20 or 25% of the ebook market. But that has actually been a very expensive proposition for Barnes & Noble. They've spent a lot of money on their digital division, and it's really been an unsustainable thing for them. This week, with the resignation of William Lynch, you know, we see a huge statement in like how this company really needs to make a new digital strategy, and it's unclear what that is going to be. Another thing that's very interesting this week is that with Mr. Lynch going out the door, Len Riggio, who's the chairman of Barnes & Noble, is left with a lot more prominence and a lot more power over what's happening within the company. Mr. Riggio is very devoted to the stores. He's always been much more interested in what's happening with the retail stores than with the digital side of the company. So we might see a shift in attention.
Back to the brick and mortar stores and away from the digital.
Back to the brick and mortar. And it really is the brick and mortar stores that do continue to make money, even though print books are declining, according to the numbers. Barnes & Noble says that their retail stores are still doing well.
Just to go into the Nook a little bit more, this had something to do with the color version, right? That wasn't a success or wasn't as successful as the black and white version?
That's right. I mean, this is really an industry-wide shift away from the black and white e-reader that really can only do one thing, which is to read a digital reproduction of a print book, and toward color tablets, obviously the iPad, Samsung, and Amazon has a very successful version of its own called the Kindle Fire. So Barnes & Noble thought that in order to keep fighting in this tablet race, they had to make their own, so they created their own color tablet. One of the problems is that Barnes & Noble did not have all the content that Amazon did. So if you buy a Kindle Fire, you're not only getting the ability to read books on it, you're getting the ability to watch videos, to, you know, watch movies, TV shows, and play games, whereas Barnes & Noble never had as much content as Amazon did. And I think that was one of the fatal things about the failure of the color tablets.
Wow, not a good week for Barnes & Noble.
No.
So we're a long way from You've Got Mail, where Barnes & Noble was this sort of huge giant crushing its indie stalwarts. But
yes, and it's interesting when, you know, you talk to people in the publishing industry these days, one of their main worries right now is what's going to happen to Barnes & Noble. They really depend on those 675 stores in all 50 states as showrooms for their books. They count on customers browsing the stores and discovering books that they didn't know that they wanted. And I think there's a huge fear in the industry right now about what might happen if that goes away.
So maybe Riggio will then save the brick and mortar side.
That's what everyone's hoping.
All right. Well, thanks, Julie.
Thanks.
How much I make a year. I mean, even if I told you, you wouldn't believe it. Do you know what would happen if I suddenly decided to stop going into work? A business big enough that it could be listed on the NASDAQ goes belly up, disappears, It ceases to exist without me. No, you clearly don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
Difficult Men is the book behind the scenes of a creative revolution from The Sopranos and The Wire to Mad Men and Breaking Bad. Brett Martin is the author. He joins us now. Hi, Brett.
Hello.
So what inspired you to look at the new cable television drama and the men in front and behind of those shows?
I, like most people in the last decade or so, began maybe 5-6 years ago to get the sense that something had dramatically changed on television, where if you are above, you know, the age of 30, you probably started out life with the being totally understood that television was a cultural wasteland, something, a guilty pleasure, the kind of thing that smart people talked about not watching. Not even having a television used to be a cocktail party cliche. That had changed dramatically at some point. What you were finding instead was that the most culturally relevant pieces of art being produced suddenly were popping up on what had previously been the boob tube. And I wasn't alone, I don't think, in noticing this.
But, you know, the book isn't called sort of How TV Became Great and Culturally Significant, but it's called Difficult Men. How did you come upon that theme and that narrative?
The title's meant to serve two purposes. The first being that the signature theme of the best of the shows of the last decade and a half has been a very complicated male anti-hero. The most famous and sort of the one that catapulted that into the public consciousness was Tony Soprano, and unfortunately, we've had reason to revisit how amazing James Gandolfini's performance was in creating Tony most recently. And you see that over the course, almost to the point of cliched repetition, is the trope that kind of defines this era, whether it's Tony Soprano and then or Vic Mackey on The Shield, who was a corrupt cop, the cops and the robbers of The Wire, certainly a serial killer named Dexter, Don Draper, who could, you know, is really only a kind of degree away from Tony in many ways.
He's not killing people quite yet.
Not quite yet, no. And, you know, which is a significant distinction. I do, but nevertheless, he plays a similar game with the audience, which is this kind of seduction repulsion thing, which is really kind of the most charged dynamic of this era of television, which is the ways in which we are attracted to these characters, find ourselves rooting for these characters, and yet are also repelled by them and wonder, and then look inward and ask ourselves, why do we want Walt White, let's say, from Breaking Bad, to succeed when he's really a monster?
This isn't the subject of your book, obviously, but while we're on the topic of these difficult men and the way they're represented both on the screen and then, I'm assuming, behind the scenes as well, where are the women in this, and are they difficult?
They are, yeah, I think so. I mean, to say that the dominant theme has been masculinity and male difficulty is not to say that there weren't also incredible female characters being created that had similar issues. I mean, there are a handful of shows, too few shows, certainly too few that are an hour long instead of a half hour, that put the female characters front and center. I'm thinking of Damages.
Weeds and Homeland.
The United States of Tara, which was on Showtime a few years ago. Part of the answer is they are there, and certainly actresses beyond the age at which Hollywood traditionally rewards them with great roles have learned that television is the place to go to play great characters.
Well, you got Laura Dern just done that, I think, in like two series now, right?
Sure. Glenn Close did it in two series. And I think the supporting characters, I think Carmela Soprano was an incredible character. I think Peggy Olson is an incredible character. I think, many of these shows, I think Skyler White is a role of a lifetime.
So you have your sequel made already set out for you there.
We'll see. Yeah, exactly. Well, the problem is that the other part of what that title means is the men who made this show.
Right.
And they, too, are primarily men in this era for a variety of reasons. And they, too, are a complicated, interesting group of people, not murderers.
Big personalities,
I think. As far as I know, I don't know, but they are. So the title's meant to have a kind of double meaning. And, you know, hopefully we're seeing that change also, where more and more women have begun to be empowered to have to take on this role of showrunner, which is the sort of auteur of this new generation of TV.
Just going into, you know, you talk about these characters and the attraction-repulsion dynamic. Is that something that we as viewers, that we've changed and we now want to see it, but we didn't before, or we wanted to see it in film? Or is it a function of, you know, just these particular stories and this moment in sort of network versus cable and what these particular creators of the shows came up with?
Well, I think it's both. I think there was, you know, the abiding myth of television was that while audiences might care to be challenged by difficult characters out in the movie theater, they wouldn't accept it in their own home, that there was something too intimate, too close, that television existed for comfort and you know, sort of confirmation rather than challenge. As it turns out, that may have been simply what served advertisers. There's a whole set of changes that takes place that no longer makes that as important. And once you take that away, and there are other motives, specifically what we call brand, identity, buzz, water cooler, attention. Once that takes on an almost equal footing with sheer number of viewers, all of a sudden the rules are changed completely. And in fact, there's an incentive to be shocking, dangerous, risky. And I think audiences found it.
Well, it's all worked out very well for us viewers. Thank you, Brett, for being here.
Thank you so much.
That was Brett Martin, author of Difficult Men, Behind the Scenes of a Creative Revolution, From the Sopranos and The Wire to Mad Men and Breaking Bad. Greg Coles is here to talk about bestseller news. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What is new on the list this week?
Well, on the combined fiction list, there are a few new titles. Starting at number 3, Jodi Ellen Malpas has a book called This Man Confessed. It is the final book of her This Man trilogy. What's interesting about this being on the combined list is that it's only been released as an ebook. So it's, you know, further evidence of the strength of the ebook market among what everybody's reading. Then the next two new titles are on the hardcover list as well. At number 5, Laurel K. Hamilton has a new entry in her Anita Blake Vampire Hunter series. That's called Affliction.
And there's zombies, too, in there.
There are zombies. It's vampires and zombies. That's new at number 5 on the combined list and also at number 5 on the hardcover list. And at number 6 on the combined list, Karen Slaughter. It's a new title in an old series also. That's the Will Trent series. That's called Unseen, new at number 6 on the combined list, new at number 10 on the hardcover list. And then the final new title on the combined fiction list this week, which does not appear on the hardcover list, it's at number 10 on the fiction list, is Cressley Cole's McCreeve. It's the 13th in a paranormal series that she does called Immortals After Dark.
Lots of series, lots of genre.
Yeah, lots of paranormal books on the combined list this week.
Twilight readers grow up.
And on the nonfiction combined list, there's a few new titles, too. At number 4, a book that surprises me a little bit that it's not on the hardcover nonfiction list, Jenny Rivera, the Mexican-American singer, huge, huge pop star in the Mexican-American pop, who died in a plane crash late last year, has an authorized autobiography, the only book that she was working on ever as an autobiography. She was still working on it when she died. Her co-writer Marissa Mateo finished it and released it. It's called Unbreakable. That's new at number 4. Then at number 14, the conservative media activist James O'Keefe, who became famous doing these undercover videos. He's the one who broke open the Acorn scandal.
That's right.
Yeah, and various other things where he's these kind of sting operations with undercover cameras. He has a book out called Breakthrough. And at number 15, Daniel James Brown's The Boys in the Boat, which is about the University of Washington's 1936 crew team, finally makes the combined list. It's been hanging out on the hardcover nonfiction list for 5 weeks now.
I can think of all kinds of bad metaphors having to do with rowing, but I'll spare our listeners.
Then I did want to mention also on the hardcover fiction list, a book that didn't make the combined list but cracks the hardcover fiction list this week. At number 12 on the hardcover fiction list, a guy named Ian Dosher has a book called William Shakespeare's Star Wars that's published by Quirk Books, who also published Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. And it is a retelling, reimagining of the original Star Wars movie as a five-act play written in iambic pentameter. I talked to Dosher. He's a Yale graduate. He graduated with a music degree and then went on to a couple of advanced degrees in theology.
Lest anyone think this is lowbrow.
He still does write music. He's a singer-songwriter. And he told me that before he wrote this book, he had written a lot of comic poetry and sonnets to commemorate events, that kind of thing. So he's certainly familiar with writing verse. He's a big Shakespeare fan. He got the idea for this book shortly after both rewatching the original Star Wars trilogy and then attending the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in Ashland. He had just read Pride and Prejudice and Zombies and had the idea that this might make an interesting mashup, and he wrote to Quirk to see if they were interested. They were. And he sat down, he wrote the first act in just a couple of weeks and sent it off to them, and it was kind of full speed ahead on that.
He said that, you know, Star Wars seemed to call out for iambic pentameter, right?
It's funny, there are portions of it where R2-D2, the little droid, gets his lines in iambic pentameter, but they're still beep, beep, squeak, meep, mo. It's a cute book.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.